The third gateway, energize your body. Your body is the only thing you are guaranteed to keep for a lifetime. It forms the foundation of your earthly existence. Energizing your body enriches your life by enhancing every human capacity. If you lack vitality, nothing else really matters. If you have your health, anything is possible. If you don't take care of your body, where will you live? Now we turn to energizing your body. And before I get into that, I want to read you some questions. Are you satisfied with your body as it is right now? What would you rather change, your appearance or your energy level? On a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate your energy level in general? Does your body function as well as you would like? How much time each day do you spend on the health and fitness of your body? How much time do you spend maintaining or improving your physical strength, your stamina, or your flexibility? Consider your priorities. Do you listen to your body? Do you treat your body with care and kindness? What three things do you like most about your body? What three things do you like least about your body? And was that a little easier to contemplate? Did that come quicker? What can you change and what can you learn to accept and appreciate of those things you don't like? Physical body is an interesting thing. Because just as we take daily life for granted, we certainly take our body for granted. Many people come up to me because they're interested. They ask me questions. They're interested in traveling out of their body before they've even gotten into it. They want to reincarnate before they've really fully incarnated. There are people who have asked me questions like, Dan, you'll know, do angels wear earrings? Where is Abe Lincoln right now? I don't know these things. I generally ask them if they're getting enough rest, eating a good balanced diet, and exercising regularly. There are very few guarantees in this life. Very few guarantees. Are you guaranteed to keep your money? No. Are you guaranteed to keep your children? No, unfortunately. Are you guaranteed to keep your house, your car, your spouse, your partner, your friends, even your beliefs? No guarantees. All of them can be washed away. There's only one thing you are guaranteed to keep your entire lifetime. That's your body. It's the only thing, in a sense, you really own. Or at least are leasing. Only thing. If I only owned one thing in the world, I'd take pretty good care of it. Many of us feed our animals better. Boy, if many of us ate like our dogs, there's your lunch, that's it. You're done until dinner. We have a love-hate relationship with our bodies. Our bodies give us pain, you know, they give us problems. With their low energy sometimes, they can betray us ultimately by dying on us. So we want to find an escape clause, a loophole. So we identify with this thing living like a bird in a cage, with this body that we have to live with. But there are many masters who say that you can only be enlightened through the body. Does energizing your body mean looking everybody like athletes? No. There are genetic predispositions. It's about optimizing your genetic potential. Some of us are going to be rounder than others, some skinnier, some taller, some shorter. That's fine. We're each like multicolored flowers in a vase. Each of us contributes to the beauty of the whole. And I mean this with all sincerity. Everyone is beautiful to me. When you look with the eyes of the heart, everybody's beautiful. It's not this social thing, and it changes over time about how the body's supposed to look in men or women. Everybody's so interesting to me. So it's not about looking a certain way. It's about energizing your body, energizing your life. Why would you want to energize your body? Why don't I say, you know, becoming really fit or healthy? Well, there are three reasons to energize your body. One, it frees your attention, right? We talked about this before, liberating your attention. If you're going, oh, my back hurts, I feel stiff, I feel low energy, it's hard to have that free attention to notice life around you. Notice the beauty around you. Second, when your body is energized, every human capacity is enhanced. You can have lots of muscles, but if you have no energy, you're not going to be very strong, are you? More energy means greater strength. You're also mentally brighter. You're quicker. You know that from experience. When you're really feeling a lot of energy, you're bright. You're more aware, actually. You have better intuition, higher intuitive capacities, stronger charisma, sense of presence. Every quality a human being has is bumped up with more energy. That's why we want to energize the body. It's a whole different way of living. Now, is the secret taking in more energy? No. You're already getting loads of energy through the air you breathe, the prana, chi, ki, whatever you call it. In different cultures, it's called different things. Life energy. Through the food you eat. Through the people around you, the energy of friends around you. We're taking in energy all the time. It's not how to take in more energy. No, there are breathing exercises you can do, pranayama and some kundalini exercises and so on. But just by breathing deeply and remembering to breathe now and then, how many of you remember to take one deep breath an hour? Where you just go, oh yeah, quick, your watch beeps. You know, we breathe shallow sometimes the whole day. No wonder we don't feel too energized. The only time most of us breathe deeply is when we're forcing ourselves to, through exercise. But just to remember to take a deep breath. We bleed off energy. And the way it works is this. The way we manage energy, we are like a hose, a garden hose, with energy flowing through us. The Chinese have a whole cosmology, acupuncture, acupressure, around these energy meridians, flowing energy in and around us. It's a stream of energy. When that hose is clear, when we're unblocked, energy flows rapidly. We can maintain a high energy level, and all kinds of so-called mystical experiences can happen. Subtle perceptions, all the fascinating stuff. Moments of high energy and free attention. But when that hose is obstructed, when there are knots or blocks inside that hose, the energy flowing through, like water flowing through a hose, becomes turbulent. Does that make sense? Eddies are formed. Rapid. Because it's flowing over blocks. What we experience when we have blocks in our mind or emotions, our body, physical obstructions, misaligned posture, when we have fear and sorrow and anger and regrets and anxieties and worries going on, those are like obstructions inside this free flow of energy. So we feel immense discomfort or even pain, physical pain, emotional pain, mental pain. We don't like that pain. We want to feel better. There are two ways to feel better. One way is to clear the obstructions, right? We call that spiritual practice, personal growth. We work on the mind, the emotions, the body. And pretty soon the energy is flowing freely. But many people don't know how to do that. They take the shortcut method. Now, if you have water flowing rapidly through a hose that has obstructions, it's going to create a lot of turmoil. But what if you slow the flow of water down to a trickle? There won't be much rapids, will there? Not much turmoil. So what we do is we bleed off the energy. We leak the energy. We keep leaking. And we have 12 primary leaks in the arenas of the 12 gateways. Some people use drugs, alcohol, tobacco. Some people use over-exercise. They get compulsive in exercise and feel depressed if they don't exercise. Maybe they exercise 4 hours a day. Some people eat heavy meat consumption. You know how after a big meal, take a nap, your energy goes down? Some people are quote-unquote addicted to orgasms, a lot of orgasms, because that again bleeds off the energy. They feel relaxed again and better. There are a number of ways we release energy from our bodies. Diet, over-exercise, and so on. The key is, when you clear the obstructions, you don't need to blow off the energy. You don't need to bleed it off or release it as much. You can allow it and maintain a higher energy level in your body. So what all the gateways are about are clearing these obstructions. and our energy level starts to rise. And the third and brief reason is energizing your body prepares you for the gateways to come. What did our grandmothers tell us? If you don't have your health, what have you got? Virtually any millionaire that I've ever met who's not feeling well or who's very ill would trade the money in a minute for an energized, vital, healthy body. We take it for granted. Because with that, everything follows. We can't really talk about the next gateway, manage your money, if we have no energy. Energy attracts energy, right? So that's the third reason we want to energize our body. Let's talk about the immune system. Many of us are worried about today about new diseases and illness and bacteria and germs, but it's funny how when a flu is going through or cold germs are going through, they're around us all the time for the most part, bacteria, viruses, and so on. Sometimes we catch something and other times we don't. Even during the plagues, the great plagues of history, some people caught it and some people didn't. Was it God punishing some and rewarding others? No. It's simply a matter of the immune system. If your immune system is strong, you don't have to worry so much. You practice natural hygiene. You wash your hands. When I go on tour, I shake a lot of hands. I wash my hands a lot. There are practical things we can do in daily life to not be swarmed by bacteria and viruses. But mostly you want to keep a healthy immune system. An energized body has a stronger immune system. There are three primary causes of physical illness. One is toxicity. You all know what toxicity is like. You're aware of that. When you've partied a little too much around the holidays, you've eaten more food than you can effectively eliminate, and your breath feels funny and you feel sluggish and full and so on. That's toxicity when you take in more than you can eliminate effectively. Second reason for illness is enervation. Enervation is being tired, fatigued, and it's not the kind of healthy fatigue that comes from a good workout. It's the kind of fatigue that's stressed over time. Overworking at work, you're stressed out, and you're just exhausted a lot. When you overdo it, not enough rest. And the third reason is imbalance. When the body's thrown out of whack. Chronic, strong, emotional upsets over time. Kind of suppressed, holding back on emotions. When you're really not confronting those emotional issues, it can throw the body out of balance. Bloodstream out of balance. Too much acid or base, so the body does a lot to balance itself. Imbalance is the third reason. So if you avoid toxicity, avoid enervation, and avoid imbalances, remain centered, your immune system is stronger, and it helps to energize your body. The Holy Trinity of health. What do you think is the most important aspect of health that you can control? Is it diet? Nope, it's exercise. Pablo Airola, who has dedicated his life to studying nutrition, studied long-lived peoples all over the world, said it's better to eat a standard American diet, abbreviated SAD, SAD, and exercise regularly than to eat a perfect organic vegetarian or vegan diet, natural foods only, and not exercise. Exercise is the key. So exercise is the first of the Holy Trinity of health. The second area is diet. And let me just relate to you briefly seven dietary principles. First, less food. Doesn't mean starve yourself. It means a little bit less food. Leave a little on your plate. Many of us have been conditioned to do otherwise. I actually feel best often when I'm on tour because I don't have a pantry to sneak into and I eat less. Doesn't mean starve yourself. Let's make that clear. See, long-lived peoples eat maybe three-quarters or half the calories that developed cultures eat. There were some studies. One rat study, they gave some rats half rations, and later they tested them for immune response and health and long life. The rats lived longer, the ones that ate less. Their immune systems were stronger. In every way, they did far better than the rats who ate whatever and how much they wanted. So eat less. Slightly less food. This is not good advice for someone who's anorexic, for example. But other than an eating disorder, for most of us, we do better eating a little bit less instead of that second helping. Give it a little time and see if you're still hungry 20 minutes later. Less food. Second principle. Less protein. Less protein. So many of us are afraid of not getting enough protein. When I became a vegetarian, by the way, I don't like to label myself. I'm not really a vegetarian. I just haven't particularly been hungry for meat for about 35 years. But I don't tell people, don't eat meat anymore. There are many good reasons not to, but I don't tell people that because each of us is different. Some people, some of us here have a certain kind of energy level where we get a little spaced out if we don't eat any animal products at all. So it's not my religion, vegetarianism. I found it works best for me. I eat very few animal products at all. And I'm 92 years old. Well, that's a slight exaggeration. Less protein. But I had a lot of fears. But if I don't eat meat, how will I get my protein to be strong? My coach, when I told him I was a vegetarian, said, Dan, you know, you're going to have to eat meat for your strength. My doctor at that time said, your leg, I had shattered my right leg in a motorcycle accident years ago. He said, you've got to eat meat for the iron. Well, I fooled them both. I was one of the strongest gymnasts in the country that year. And my leg healed extraordinarily quickly. You don't need to worry about protein. You don't need to stuff with tofu. Frances Moore LePay, in her book Diet for a Small Planet, in her first edition of the book, said you have to combine certain foods to make the complete amino acids so you can get the protein. Her second edition, she said, I'm sorry, I was wrong. Just eat a variety of foods. All foods have protein. All foods have amino acids. Just eat a varied diet. I haven't owned a scale for years. The only thing a scale is good for is to do weight strength exercises with. And I haven't worried about protein for years. The diseases associated with protein in this world are not from lack of protein. They're from too much protein. Far more illness and disease from too much protein than from lack of it. But we have this fear. We've grown up with it. We've been programmed by certain industries, primarily meat and dairy. You've got to have your meat. You've got to have your dairy. Not so. Dave Scott, 3-time Ironman triathlon, most endurance athletes, eat very little animal protein. So, am I suggesting don't eat protein? Of course not. You can't not eat protein. You'll get plenty. But eat less. Again, long-lived cultures, the Hunzas, those in Russia, many cultures around the world, they eat far less protein than we do. The third dietary principle is eat a variety of foods. Some of us get locked into certain foods, but there's a survival value in a variety of foods. In other countries, many people grow this hybrid grains that have different kinds of grains. We tend to get pure grains, just pure white rice and certain flours. The more grains, 9-grain breads, things like that, I recommend. Variety of foods. The fourth is experiment. Trust your instincts. There was a study done with young children in which children were given a variety of foods in front of them, and these are about 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds. They were allowed to eat whatever they found appealing. And some kids would go right up to the carbohydrates, the sweet rolls, the jelly things, and eat those for maybe half a day. They'd just sit there and stuff on those because, boy, they taste good. But after a while, the children gravitated somewhere else. They didn't keep going back. They went over and munched on carrots or apples, slices, or they'd go eat some more animal protein or whatever. What happened was, even though they would select different things, someone monitored each child's food over the 2 weeks. And over the 2-week period, the children had eaten a well-balanced diet. And they'd never read Adele Davis or a health book. We need to trust our instincts, but we need to refine our instincts as well. You refine your instincts. How do you do that? Exercise, and once in a while you do a brief fast. If you have fasted more than 2 days, at the end of the fast, you know the last thing you want to eat is a candy bar. You want whole grain cereal, or you have a craving for a carrot or an apple or fruit. Your instincts are tuned up. That's one of the benefits of fasting. So you tune up your instincts through exercise and occasional fasting. Anything can be overdone. Some people get addicted to fasting. I should mention that. Some people, every 2 weeks, they're doing a 5-day fast. That's too much. Because you feel real spacey. Your hunger goes away after about a day and a half. You're not hungry anymore. And then it's fun to prepare food for other people. The smells, you can smell food across the house. It's amazing how your nostrils start to work better. Your olfactory sense. You feel light. You feel like you could walk forever. So some people say, I don't feel like I need to eat anymore. Bad idea. Point is, you can overdo or underdo anything. That's the law of balance. But you trust your instincts. Ultimately, read the labels, but also check out, how do I feel after eating this food? That's why I don't give rules about only fruit in the morning, only protein in lunch, and so on. Because those rules, there's no minimum daily requirement for anybody. That's an artificial abstract. You may need more or less than someone sitting next to you of different nutrients. That's why ultimately the only way to know is to trust your instincts. Instinctual eating. Find out what works for you. It's more important than what you read. In fact, Mark Twain once wrote, be careful of reading health books. You may die of a misprint. Okay? I already mentioned fasting is the fifth principle for energizing your body. And the sixth one is eat more foods containing water, a lot of water. We're a high percentage of water. Our bodies are made up of that. So you want to eat foods that have a lot of water content, which comes down to primarily fruits and vegetables. But drink water a lot. I drink equivalent of about 2 glasses of water before I get out of bed in the morning. Generally, filtered water, purified water, bottled water. Most of us don't drink enough. Drink more water and eat foods that bear a lot of water, fruits and vegetables. You'll feel better. And finally, treat eating as a sacred ritual. This is the most difficult area for me. I tend to eat quickly, and it's a very difficult habit to break. I believe we all have a natural pace of eating, which may be different for someone else. Again, about trusting your instincts. But in general, if we pay attention to what we're eating, once in a while, put the book down, turn the TV off once in a while, and notice what you're eating. Pay attention to, just as a discipline, now and then. Take a breath between every time you chew, swallow. Take one deep breath. Even put your fork or spoon down and then pick it up again. It's so easy to take food for granted. That way we treat food as a sacrament, not just saying grace. I don't do any particular religious ritual before I eat, but I often just put my hands together and dedicate the energy from the food in service of others. It doesn't take long. You can do it inauspiciously. Nobody even notices. Just one deep breath and then you eat. That's also an important dietary principle. You can eat the best food in the world, but if you gorge it down, don't digest it as well. And my belief is you don't get it quite as much out of it. Other than that, I don't have a lot to say about diet because there's plenty written on the subject, innumerable books, but it comes down to those seven principles. You apply those and it's going to help take care of your diet. The Holy Trinity of health, exercise, diet, and finally getting enough rest. You've probably read in the newspapers how we're a sleep-deprived nation. This may be true in many places in the world. Think of what it was like before the electric light bulb, before oil lamps. People flowed their lives flowed with the natural rhythms of the sun, the moon. When the sun went down, it was time. You couldn't see much. Torches, maybe. So you went to sleep. And when the sun was up, it was time to get up. That's a natural alarm clock. But we stay up late watching the TV program just to finish it. Even if we have a VCR. Aren't people funny? We stay up late. And we don't get enough sleep. That's why we often are sleepy in the afternoon. Normally you shouldn't get sleepy in the afternoon unless you've eaten something you're allergic to. You often get sluggish after lunch. Or you didn't sleep enough the night before. Then if we take a nap late in the day, then it's harder to get to sleep at night and these cycles continue. So getting enough rest is very, very important. Those three things will take care of so much. Often we think we have these spiritual problems and we have emotional problems, and often these will be taken care of with a good diet. In fact, let me read you a couple of quotes you might enjoy. Lord Chesterfield wrote, "A light supper and a good night's sleep have often made a hero out of the same person who, by indigestion and a restless night, would have proved a coward." So diet affects a great deal about what you think is emotional issues and relationship issues. Your diet. Thaddeus Golas, in his little gem of a book, A Lazy Man's Guide to Enlightenment, once said, "The way you perceive the world depends entirely on your energy. When your energy changes, the world will look different." Let's do a breathing exercise. When people ask me, "Dan, how do you breathe?" You know, they've read Way of the Peaceful Warrior and they go, "Now I remember Socrates, your teacher in that book, told you to keep your tongue on the roof of the mouth. That seems to be such a key for them." And I go, "Well, sure, that way you breathe through your nose and it keeps the bugs out, you know?" It's a subtle thing, energy circulation, the tongue and the roof of the mouth. But it's a natural place to let the tongue rest. When people ask me how to breathe, I say, I often recommend in, then out. In, then out. But there are more things to know about breathing. Yes, we breathe automatically. If the body has all these mechanisms where we haven't breathed deeply enough. But there is a way to learn to breathe that can calm you, help center you, relax you, release stress. And let's do that now. Would you put one hand on your chest, if you're able to do this where you are right now, and one hand on your lower belly? First, we're going to breathe deliberately the wrong way, which is what most people do. You see, young babies, they'll breathe their little bellies going in and out. You'll see their little bellies moving. And often adults, when they're asleep and relaxed, their bellies will move when they breathe. But most of us, because the mind imposes tension on the body, most of us breathe more in our upper chest. We breathe with our intercostal muscles and our chest. So I'm going to ask you to breathe the wrong way on purpose now. Breathe only in your upper chest and breathe 30 shallow and rapidly. In other words, nothing should move but your upper hand. Your bottom hand shouldn't be moving at all. Upper hand go. Okay, that's not much fun, is it? What do you associate that with? What emotional state do you associate that kind of breathing with? Fear or anxiety, yes. Almost universally, anxiety. And often we're going around through our day slightly anxious. When we're driving, when we're at work, when we're worried about the kids, whatever. And our breathing tends to be shallow. Now let's do the opposite. Your diaphragm is a bell-shaped muscle inside, dividing your intestinal cavity from your lung cavity, your thoracic, your chest cavity. And when you inhale, the diaphragm pulls down, flattens out, and it sucks air into the lungs. And it expands your belly. When you relax, the diaphragm comes back up. So now I'd like you to breathe consciously with your diaphragm only. If this is difficult for you, at home you can try lying on your back with a heavy book or weight on your stomach and feel the weight rising and falling as you breathe. As you inhale, your belly comes out, so only your lower hand on your abdomen should be moving, not your chest at all. As you inhale, the belly should come out, expand. As you exhale, the belly relaxes back in. Feel that a few times. Expanding. Just the belly moving. Tongue on the roof of the mouth. Breathing through the nose. Feel the belly moving. Do you notice how relaxing that is? In only a few breaths, you can calm right out. Now, am I suggesting you breathe all the time that way? No. But if you're in repose, if you're sitting, meditating, writing, reading, watching television, just to develop the habit. It's a natural habit. At first, it feels artificial. You have to consciously remember, practice breathing with the belly more and more. Very relaxing. It'll lower blood pressure, for one thing. Make you more calm and clear. But what about if you're exercising? Are you going to breathe only with your belly? No. You want to use your whole breathing capacity. Your thoracic muscles, your intercostal muscles. Even you breathe with the back. Your back actually expands as well when you breathe. Use your full breath capacity. I'm going to teach you an exercise you can do now to get twice the benefit, maybe three times the benefit from going for a walk. Walking, as you know, is the most natural exercise in the world. I ran for years, and some people like running, great. If your knees and back and everything are doing fine, you wear very good shoes, that's very important. Good shoes. Human beings are made to be able to run long distances, but not necessarily on concrete. That's why you need good shoes today. So if you're going to run, run. I'm not telling you not to run. But what we can always do, and what I do now, is I walk. I walk briskly, either swinging my arms straight or with my arms bent, different styles. But walking briskly, it's a wonderful exercise. You use more muscles when you walk than when you run. Sometimes you don't think you've got as good a workout because you haven't pounded yourself as hard. You're not panting as much. But walking on, carrying a conversation, it's one of the best exercises there are. In fact, another quotation you might enjoy. Aldous Huxley, the writer, once said, "In all activities of life, the secret of efficiency lies in the ability to combine two seemingly incompatible states, a state of maximum activity with a state of maximum relaxation." I'm going to take you through a very fast relaxation exercise before we do anything else. Sit comfortably, please. Now feel your belly. Become aware of your belly. Expanding and contracting. Expanding and contracting as you breathe. Breathing through the nose. Imagine what it would be like to have your body pleasantly heavy, skin heavy, bones heavy, the entire body heavy. What would that like that feel like? The entire body heavy. Imagine your feet weigh 1,000 pounds each, just your feet. Skin heavy, bones heavy, and the whole body is heavy. Don't worry about whether you're relaxed yet or not. And that heaviness creeps up through your ankles, through your calves, shins, up to the knees. Your entire lower legs, heavy. Skin, bones, the whole body heavy. If your feet were heavy, just think how heavy your entire legs could be. Skin, bones, whole body heavy. Now the heaviness goes up through your entire chest and back, up the lower back, up the spine, under the shoulder blades, throughout the chest, up through the shoulders. Now that heaviness goes down through your upper arms, your elbows, your forearms, and the palms, the entire hand, out to the fingertips, so that your entire body, below the head, below the neck, is heavy. Skin, bones, the whole body, heavy. Now feel the muscles releasing around the neck, the front of the neck, the back, the sides. And now, as I mentioned, parts of your face and scalp, feel those parts release, relax, be pulled down and relax with gravity. The scalp relaxes. Your forehead and eyebrows release. Around the eye sockets, heavy. Around the cheekbones, the ears, the jaw, the mouth, and the chin, so that your entire body is heavy, skin heavy, bones heavy, the whole body heavy. You could be floating on a warm ocean, a safe ocean, floating up with each breath and down with each exhalation, floating up with each inhalation as your belly rises and falls. Now imagine yourself doing a favorite activity, a sport you enjoy, dancing, or perhaps just walking. And imagine yourself moving with the same relaxation, using only the muscles you need and only to the extent you need them. Flowing, striding along. Maximum energy. Minimum tension. Moving with great efficiency and relaxation. Now I'm going to ask you to take 3 deep breaths, each one deeper than the last. And on the 3rd deep breath, starting with your belly, expanding into your entire chest, open your eyes. And when you're back here, wide awake, still relaxed, I'm going to ask you to stand for a moment. Whenever you're ready, stand up. Staying relaxed. What would it be like to be this relaxed moving throughout the day? Now, walk with me in place. One, two. Just lift one heel off the ground, then the other heel off the ground. In the same rhythm. One, two. One, two. As we do this, I'm going to ask you to inhale for two breaths, or two steps. Then exhale for two steps. So it would be like this. Inhale two and exhale two. So it's... And then exhale two. Standing in place. Walking in place. Inhale two. Exhale two. Okay, stop for a moment. This is how you get much more from a walk. By doing progressive inhalations. Breathing to a count. Inhale for two steps and exhale for two steps. Then inhale for three steps. Exhale for three steps. Inhale for four steps. And so on. Now I've gone with much practice. I can walk, go for a walk, and inhale for 20 steps and exhale for 20. But that takes a lot of practice. Just experience this. Notice when you get up to about six steps to an inhale and exhale, you don't want to inhale too quickly or you'll get stuck. You'll inhale all your air and you'll be stuck. So you have to control the amount of air that comes in and goes out with your throat. So breathe slower as you breathe deeper. You can get so much deeper benefits from a walk by once in a while doing this breathing to a count. When I go for a walk, I work up to 20 because that's what I've developed, and then back down, 19, 18, 17. If you go for a short walk, you can do it by twos. Whenever I go to a parking lot of a major, like a shopping center, movie theater, I always immediately go for the furthest parking space away. That way I can walk every day. You don't have to necessarily say, I'm going to go for a walk. Walking to the shopping mall, wherever, whenever you walk, doing this exercise can expand your lung capacity. You literally breathe easier. And one of the keys to long life is your vital capacity, how deeply you can breathe. My lung capacity is quite good from doing this exercise. You can do it walking on level ground, on a stationary bike. You can do it on a little rebounder, those little trampolines, which I recommend. They're very, very good, these small trampolines. You can do this many, many different... I taught a quadriplegic this exercise. He did it to a metronome. With tears in his eyes, he told me that it helped him more than all the fancy yogic breathing exercises he'd ever learned. Breathing to a count. Very, very useful. Go for walks. Has a great deal to do with energizing your body. Now, I want to tell you one other practical thing you can do, because a peaceful warrior's approach to life is not about some Spartan marine discipline. It's something accessible to us all. It's practical. We can integrate it in daily life. From the time you start standing up when you're a toddler, did you know that you lost at least a quarter of an inch of height as soon as you stood up? Yeah, babies do when they're measured before and after they start. Because when you stand up, gravity begins its compression of your vertebral column, your hips, everywhere else. Gravity pushes down constantly until we go to bed at night and finally lie horizontally. Gravity is constantly pushing our bodies, and when we get older, if we don't exercise, we can get osteoporosis and we start losing the battle, so to speak, with gravity. We compress. Older people are rarely taller. They tend to get shorter. How would you like to know a simple, practical, powerful way to change gravity from a compressing force to an extending, stretching, elasticizing, elongating, balancing force, opening the whole body? One magical thing you can do. In fact, it'll give you the equivalent of 15 minutes of body work, of massage, in about 20 to 30 seconds. Would you be interested in knowing this? Well, then I will tell you. You go to a local sporting goods store, and you buy one of those bars that you can screw into your doorway. And every day, in the morning and maybe evening, or when you pass through the doorway, you hang from it. Now, yes, there are fancy gravity boots and things you can hang upside down. That's very good for some people, not good for others. But anybody can hang. Even if you think I'm not strong enough to hold my body weight, you can partially support yourself by your feet until your grip gets stronger and you can finally just hang. You bend your knees, you hang from the doorway. I do this every day. You know how many of us are reading or watching TV before we go to bed, and then we kind of go, oh, time to go to bed. We feel all crooked and kind of our back sore. Before I go to bed, I stretch. I hang from a bar. I completely feel my spine opening up, the hip joints opening up, the shoulders opening up. And my body was twisted or turned, gets straightened out. few other stretches, then go to bed. When I get up in the morning, anytime I pass through the doorway, there are things babies do that we don't do. It's natural. Babies love to jump up and down. That's why I recommend the little trampolines. I have a big trampoline at my house too. But jumping up and down is a natural thing. They've done studies of osteoporosis and hip problems. I just heard it on the radio the other day. People who just jump up and down a little bit, like that, jumping rope or just jumping, even a few times a day, helps alleviate osteoporotic conditions, strengthens the bones, and so on. Jumping is natural. Hanging. Little kids love to hang. They'll grab on your arm, right? And they like you to swing them. Adults, how many times? When's the last time you swang from anything? Every day. This is simple. It costs about $15 or $20. It makes a major difference in your life. These are the keys, the things we can integrate into our daily life. Now, we were talking about reclaiming the will. Most of us know it's good for us, but many of us don't do conscious exercise every day. Well, if you don't, and you'd like to, I'm going to give you a trick to reclaiming your will and doing this every day. First thing you do when you get up in the morning, people ask me if I exercise. Yeah, well, now that I'm over 50 years old, I get up and run to the bathroom. I run every day. But every day when you get up, do, if you don't do any exercise right now, daily exercise, do one jumping jack. And then go about your day. And the next day you get up, do one jumping jack, go about your day. The third day, do the same thing. After 30 days, if someone comes up to you and says, by the way, do you exercise regularly? You can say, yes, I do. Every single day, religiously. Now, you may be thinking, come on, Dan, you're not, that's not a training effect. You're not going to get more fit doing that. You're not going to get your aerobic points and so on. But you know what? It's significant. It's a huge step if you will do this. Because one, you've got your foot in the door. You set aside a certain amount of time every day, albeit small, to exercise. And you know, after the second month, you might feel like doing two jumping jacks. The third month, you might feel like walking around the block. You might even decide to learn the Peaceful Warrior Workout, which is a videotape that comes with the Nightingale Conant Path to Everyday Enlightenment program. It's a system of movement, deep breathing, movement, and flowing tension release that can be done in less than 4 minutes a day. Does anybody here not have 3.5 minutes to exercise? It's almost excuse-proof. Major benefits. I've done it every single day for the last 14 years since its inception. Makes a huge difference. A little bit of something is better than a lot of nothing. Keep this principle in mind. Start small. Start small. Makes a big difference in the long run. Doorway bar, walking every day, walking and breathing. Practical ways to energize your body. And with that, we close the third gateway, Energize Your Body. The fourth gateway, manage your money. Money is neither God nor devil, but a form of energy. Like love or fear, it can serve you or bind you, depending on how you manage it. By clarifying your goals and using your gifts, you can make good money doing what you enjoy while serving the highest calling of your soul. Using money wisely and well, you share your material and spiritual wealth with the world. We're now ready to get into the fourth gateway, a real spiritual one. Manage your money. Now, many people rightly ask, wait a minute, this is about the path to everyday enlightenment and spirituality. What does it have to do with money? You should know at the outset that money is neither my God nor my devil. Fulfilling and completing this fourth gateway is not about getting rich. This isn't a great get-rich seminar. But it's not about giving all your money away to the poor either. There are many very wealthy people who don't manage their money at all, who spend more than they make, who are in debt, who are having terrible money problems, who feel guilty about money, all kinds of issues with it. They're not managing their money. So getting wealthy doesn't automatically fulfill the gateway. If you decide to give all your earthly possessions to the poor, that's one solution. But I found that doesn't make you more spiritual. It just makes you more poor. I like to ask people, would you like $200 million? Raise your hand, please, if you would like $200 million. Okay. I'm more interested in the people who did not raise their hand. If you did not raise your hand, it very well may be because, one, you just don't like raising your hand. Or the other reason may be you say, no, I thought about it and I don't need $200 million. I live simply, I believe in living simply, and that's excess, that's ostentatious. Why do I need that? But then I remind you, I would like $500 million. I'd like billions of dollars because look what I could do with it. There's so many needed charities, Mother Teresa's charity and so many others that could use that money. And it's a wonderful philanthropic thing to do to be able to channel the money. But sometimes we don't think about that. We were only thinking, oh yeah, I don't need that much. Of course we don't need that much. Who needs that much money? My life is pretty simple. But again, I even created a peaceful warrior fund I have set up through a community foundation. And gradually, it's going to build up more and more endowment so we can start doing charitable things. I aim to be a philanthropist eventually. And I'm already doing that in a smaller degree. Right now, my major charity are my two daughters. The younger one's still living at home. So we may not need much, but look what we could do with that filtering and channeling that extra energy. Most of us do have money issues. In fact, let's go through a brief assessment about our attitudes and issues toward money. Does money frequently monopolize your attention? How much time and energy do you spend struggling to balance income and expenditures? How do you feel about wealthy people, the rich? How do you feel about poor people? Do you believe that wealthy people are somehow less spiritual or poor people more so? How do you feel about wealthy spiritual teachers? How much money would you like to earn each year? Why not more? Does money seem very hard to come by or burn a hole in your pocket? Or do you feel guilty about having a lot of money when other people don't? Are you in debt? If you are, is it due to insufficient income or overspending? Are the best things in life free? Again, these questions don't have instant answers, but they're questions to consider as we move into this area of managing your money. So let me define what I mean by managing your money. Simply put, it involves achieving stability and sufficiency. Okay? Not getting rich, not being poor, but sufficiency and stability. Why do we want to achieve sufficiency and stability? Because it frees our attention. So much of our attention. If you think about the percentage of the day, paying for lunch, going to the bank because you need some more money, wondering how you're going to afford the dental bill or the car repair. Money surprises. Expense comes in. What am I going to do about this? Money issues at business, at work, trying to get more of it. Spend less of it. Spend more of it. Should you go on vacation? How much should you spend? A great deal of our lives and energies revolve around money. And those of us who have an abundance of energy or of money, often we have some subtle guilt about it. What about that idea of the rich? The rich. You know, we say, it's okay to tax the rich more. They take more. They have more. But it turns out, those we call the robber barons of old were neither robbers nor barons. They made their money by providing a valuable service, by inventing or creating something, by providing jobs and industries. Now, if I said to you, would you like a little more money? You'd probably say, sure, I have nothing against that. Great, I could use a little more money. There are things I could do with it. But when you really contemplate attitudes, again, we're going back into that subconscious area. Money versus spirituality. I noticed there was might have been a response in you when I mentioned, how do you feel about wealthy spiritual teachers? Does that negate their value? Does that make them hypocrites? We have strong beliefs about money, and until we deal with those beliefs, it doesn't do any good to give tips for making more money or stabilizing your life, because a part of you may not want to have much money. Many of us are like Joe Louis, the boxer, who once said, "I don't really like money, but it calms my nerves." When you picture a spiritual person, a classic spiritual person, do you picture a sannyasin from India, a renunciate, a monk, a nun, a priest, people who've renounced worldly possessions for the things of spirit? We have a tremendous dichotomy in our minds about money and spirituality. I'm not the only one to say this, but I'd like to say it clear so it really strikes home. We've been programmed, all of us, in growing up. Now, by definition, when you've been programmed, you don't know you've been programmed. If you know you've been programmed, you're no longer programmed. But look at the films, popular films. They're meant for mass audiences. They're not aimed at a wealthy elite. They're aimed at mass audiences. So they deify the salt of the earth, people who are struggling, poor, but spiritual and good. How about a movie we probably, most of us have seen, It's a Wonderful Life. Many people around Christmas see that. Do you remember the evil, unethical, greedy Mr. Potter who owned half the town and wanted to own all of it, all the banks? The rich guy, the bad rich guy. Then we have George Bailey and his family. They're poor, but they're happy and spiritual. How about Christmas Carol? We have Scrooge on the one hand, and we have the Cratchits. They're happy and spiritual and loving, but poor. The Karate Kid, a more popular recent movie. He lived with his mother across the tracks, a single mother. They were struggling. Then there were these rich brats with their fancy red motorcycles and cars. Do you remember that? No wonder we grow up with some mixed feelings. The things of the world, the flesh, and then the spirit. It's about integrating those two. Let me tell you the story of my life. And I had serious money issues. And I didn't even know it. About 16 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, I was walking out of my house and I noticed across the street some very wealthy young teenage girls, maybe they were 18 or 19, getting into a Mercedes sports car. It's about a $70,000 car. And I looked at them for a minute, just kind of stared at them, you know, and then I turned around. There was like a dark cloud that passed over me, kind of a negative feeling. And if I could have given words to that feeling, it would have been something like, "Look at those little rich girls." I might have just kind of felt that way and then turned away and until new impressions entered my psyche. But in a moment of self-reflection, it was like a slap that hit me. I went, "Wait a minute, what did I just feel about them? I don't know them. They might be wonderful young ladies. My daughters were growing toward teenagehood. They dressed well. Just because they appeared to have a lot of money, I felt negatively about them." And I went, "Whoa. If that's how I feel about money, I'm sure not going to attract much of it." And as a matter of fact, during this period of time, I was mastering my poverty consciousness phase of life. At that time, I was working two jobs, getting up at 4 a.m. to do overload typing in a local law firm. I let myself in. And then I went to a real estate office from 8 o'clock until 5, doing word processing. This was after I'd written Way of the Peaceful Warrior. It went out of print for a time. That's another story. It was after I'd been a professor at Oberlin College, a college professor. But this phase, I was just broke. We were $15,000 in debt, which was a lot of money for us. I had no way of seeing my way how we were going to ever get out of debt. And we didn't live high off the hog either. Money was scarce. I was struggling. And that was a turning point when I saw my attitudes toward money. I was really unsympathetic toward the stuff. That was a turning point. I began, literally, and a few other things happened during that period. I stepped forward, started teaching seminars, sharing what I had to share. I remember the first time I came back from a seminar, and I had a handful of cash. And I said to Joy, "Close your eyes," and she opened her eyes. I threw the money in the air, let it shower down around her. Now, again, if you feel like, "Oh, that's kind of ostentatious, you know, is that love of money?" Then look at that in yourself. attitude toward money. It's just stuff. Green stuff. Trade. Somebody once said, we should go back to barter. I said, yeah, we could all be bartering. But didn't we start with that? And then somebody wanted to barter a chicken for some pottery. And they said, well, what's worth what? And they developed money to find a sense of value. And it was an easier way to barter. Point is, money is just energy. Just energy. It makes you more of who you already are. That's what more energy does. If you're loving, it'll make you more loving. If you're greedy, it'll tend to make you more greedy. It makes you more of who you already are. Anybody who listens to this tape program and has a lot of money and feels guilty about it, if money is just energy, would you wake up in the morning and say, oh, I feel so guilty. I have more energy than my neighbor. I don't think so. Money doesn't care who has it. It's just stuff. But by using your talent and your creativity and your labors to provide a service for other people, you end up producing more income for yourself. And if there's abundance there, you can share it with other people, whatever you choose to do with it. I've negotiated many contracts. And I've noticed it always comes down to the bottom line. You can negotiate screen credit or this or that, but it comes down to what's the royalties, what's the payment, bottom line. And often we set a different value for ourselves. This is when self-worth issues come in. Do you, for example, when someone says, if you work for yourself, and someone says, how much does your service cost? I know some body workers, musicians, you know, how much does your service cost? They have to... This is the moment. What am I worth? What am I worth? So money is tied up with self-worth. How much do you deserve? So think about your money issues. I've had many. I once saw a program on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. I was channel surfing. And I came across Robin Leach, and he was talking to Barbara Streisand, very talented, hardworking performer. And she was showing her house, and it was a gorgeous, gorgeous house. Some might even consider it ostentatious. And I got sort of an emotional charge when she showed her carpet. It was a beautiful, huge Persian rug, handmade for her with a specific design. And she said, occasionally, I'm very proud of this, she said, occasionally, when this carpet is taken out, the house to be cleaned, she showed underneath it, on the marble floor, it had the exact same pattern, so she could still enjoy the same pattern when the carpet was taken out to be cleaned. Now, I had a charge over this. I was like, boy, is this ostentatious. And I was starting to do those self-defeating calculations about how many starving children in India that carpet could have fed. But that makes no sense. When we start doing that, how much money this could have done. A friend of mine landed with a spiritual master in India, and they got off the plane and they looked up at the 747, and his disciple said, God, look at the cost of this airplane. Do you know how many people in India it could have fed? And the master looked up and said, yeah, but boy, it's a great airplane. The point is, it's a cosmic kind of question. There will always be people poorer than others. It's not about being heartless. We help where we can. But if you don't eat until all the poor people have been fed, you're going to starve to death. You know that saying, think globally, act locally? What you can do with your money is to help people in your local arena. It's a form of service as well. We'll be getting into that as well. So take a good look first at your attitudes toward money, whether you've been programmed or not, whether you're neutral about money, it's simply providing a service and making income, or whether there's this charge about money and spirit. Because there is in most of us. Big, big charge. Are you comfortable if someone says, how much money do you make a year? Would you share that? Some people wouldn't. Why not? You don't have to, but why wouldn't you? We'll tell about our sexual lives to strangers, but we don't want to talk about our money. That's private. So we first need to look at our money issues. Let me read you a few quotations before we go on. Tom Robbins once said, there's a certain Buddhistic calm that comes from having money in the bank. James Baldwin wrote, money is like sex. You think about it a lot when you don't have it, and think of other things when you do. Mahatma Gandhi, whom I admire greatly, once wrote, "Live simply so that others may simply live." This makes good bumper sticker copy. And yet there's something about it that's false. There's a zero-sum belief that if you have more money, someone else necessarily has less. It doesn't work that way. Ask any economist. If you make money, you can do it by providing jobs for other people, become an employer, hire people, and create more money and more wealth, and provide a service to other people. Abstaining from money doesn't make anybody else any wealthier. It's not as if there's X amount to go around. And you shouldn't take more than your share. Your share is whatever you want it to be. Will money make you happy? No. No. In fact, there was a study done, an informal study. About 270 people were called up on the telephone at random. And they were asked, if you had $1 million, would it make you happy? And 76% of the people said, yes. Then they asked 10 millionaires, did $1 million make you happy? And it was unanimous. No. So money doesn't lead to happiness, but you know what it does lead to? First of all, you get a more quiet environment. People who have a lot of money, it's quieter. The walls are thicker. There's more space around them. And they rarely stay up late at night worrying about having too much money. So money does buy a more interesting, complex set of problems. Doesn't make you happy. You're still, wherever you go, there you are. Wealthy or not. We have a belief that poor people in Africa and India are suffering horribly, and the rich and the wealthy have it all together. I know wealthy people who are suffering worse than many people I've met in India. They're suffering because the relationship is painful and self-destructive or hurting the other. They're suffering because their health is bad or because they're confused and lost, even though they've developed the talent and the drive for making a lot of money. So let's not assume so quickly that wealth means comfort and we should envy or somehow have animosity toward the wealthy. They suffer too. They're suffering everywhere. Some of the poor have family around them and loving support, and they're working hard with a purpose and drive. So we have to examine many of the assumptions we've had before. By the way, that quote of Gandhi, "Live simply so that others may simply live," people have heard that quote, many of them, but they haven't heard the wealthy industrialist who supported Gandhi's cause, who once said, "It cost me a fortune to keep Gandhi simple." I was once sitting in my hot tub. It was a used hot tub. But I was sitting in my hot tub one winter's night, and I was on my cell phone talking to my editor in Berkeley, California. And I said, "Nancy," she was very socially conscious. I thought I needed some feedback at that point. I said, "Nancy, I feel kind of guilty. You know, I'm sitting here in my hot tub feeling great on my cell phone talking to you. And I know at this moment there are starving people and starving children places around the world." And she said, "Well, that's a fact." Nancy said, "You know, Dan, though, Joan Baez once said, 'I'm not for voluntary poverty. I'm against involuntary poverty.'" Big difference. Epictetus, the Greek, said, "Contentment consists not in great wealth, but in few wants." Maybe there's some truth in that. But there are some people whose ideal is to live like Thoreau. They've read Walden. Of course, they're not aware that Thoreau lived that way for like all of 6 months during the warm months. It was a little experiment he did. But they have this ideal that I'm going to live Mother Goose apple pie beautiful in the woods. I'll have a little camper and I'll live there and I won't need much money at all. I'll minimize everything. And yet at the same time, they're not contemplating how they're going to provide a great service to humanity, just how little they can live on. I prefer saying, let's challenge ourselves. Let's get into the game. We're not out of it. Again, money doesn't care who has it. Find out your gifts, your talents. Mary Tyler Moore once said, "Three things helped me to get through life successfully: an understanding husband, an extremely good analyst, and millions of dollars." As a counterpoint, Henrik Ibsen playwright, said, "Money is the husk of life, but not the kernel. It brings you food, but not appetite. Medicine, but not health. Acquaintances, but not friends. Servants, but not faithfulness. Moments of excitement, but not inner peace." Shakespeare said, "They are well paid who are well satisfied." Do you know that saying by Hillel, if I am not for me, who will be? But if I'm only for me, what am I? Who am I? I want to tell you a story related to this, the political statement, and it's not just about individual wealth. See, my work is what we can control, and I don't have any clear control over the third world or poverty in another country, but I do have control over what I do in terms of how kind I can act and generous and so on with other people in my environment. It's all we can do. Let me tell you a story that helps resolve this issue about personal growth versus political solutions in helping the world. First of all, we need to be very careful about dealing with abstractions. The term the third world. There are times I'm on public radio and people always call up and I say anything and they go, "Yeah, but what about the third world?" And I talk about meditation. "Yeah, but what about the third world?" Then I talk about something else. "Yeah, but what about the third world?" That's a way to be miserable all the time. Just contemplate the third world your entire day as you're eating lunch. The third world, though, is an abstract idea. It's not a thing. There is no such thing as a third world. It's an abstraction we use to put on less developed countries. But they're made up of individual people. When we talk about the poor in Africa, there are some people in Africa who are poor and mean-spirited. Others are poor and generous of spirit. There are wealthy people who are greedy, others who are loving, others who are happy, others who are sad. So talking about the rich or the poor are abstractions. And the third world is also an abstraction. So we need to get down to individual cases of how people are. But let me tell the story now. Socrates and I were walking down the street in Berkeley, and we came across some posters on the wall. Now, during this period of time, I was doing a lot of work on myself. Self-massage, the Mongolian warriors used to do this. This bone massage that the warriors used to do to clear fear from the body. I was doing self-analysis and internal reflections and meditations. All this work on myself. So when we came across these posters, it provided a counterpoint for my work. One was about saving whales and dolphins. Another was about oppressed peoples. Another was about starving children around the world. And I stopped and I said, "You know, Sock, I really do feel kind of guilty. I know there's a purpose for all these things you're having me do, but I feel kind of guilty and selfish doing all this work on myself, like a me generation kind of thing. When there's so many people in need out there, shouldn't I be, you know, doing something out there?" And he stopped and looked at me for a minute, then kept walking. And I said, "Sock, did you hear what I said?" And he just stopped and said, "Take a swing at me." And I went, "What? What are you talking about? Take a swing at you? Did you hear what I was talking about?" He said, "Come on, I'll give you $5 if you can slap me on the cheek." I figured it was some kind of test. So I fainted and played around and I took a swing at him. And I found myself in the next moment in a rather painful wrist lock lying on the ground. And as he let me up, as he helped me to my feet, he said, "You notice a little leverage can be very effective?" I said, "Yeah, I noticed." He said, "Well, the fact that you want to help people is wonderful. Follow that. It's a wonderful calling. But before you can effectively help people, you have to understand them. Before you can understand other people, you have to understand yourself." He said, "At the same time, develop the clarity and the courage, the commitment to know how to exert the right leverage at the right place at the right time." What I saw in Berkeley, there was some very constructive action back in the 60s, but there was also counterproductive action. Many of us just go around doing do-gooders without being like the person who insisted on helping the older lady across the street. She's trying to beat him off with her umbrella because she didn't want to go across the street. Or people who sent to certain African villages powdered milk so they could eat, well-intentioned, but they weren't unable to digest the milk. They were whitewashing their houses with it. The U.S. is such a big-hearted country. We want to help the rest of the world, but it's how do you do it effectively? And the rest of my life, since then, I've been seeking ways to exert the right leverage at the right place at the right time. We're going to talk more about this in the 12th Gateway, though, about providing a service. I want to emphasize here, I want to emphasize, each of you has your own gifts. You have a talent that may remain undiscovered. Grandma Moses, what was she, 80 years old before she had discovered a talent for painting? You never know. There may be a hidden talent within you that you've never allowed yourself to explore. The best thing we can do for children is give them a variety of experiences so they can see what they gravitate toward. I'm going to read you two short stories to emphasize how you have a talent you may not have fully explored yet. And in that way, you can create abundance and ease and enough to share with other people as well in your life. Again, why do we want to do this? Do we want to do money for its own sake? No. But to liberate your attention. And the best thing about doing well as an author now is that the car breaks, I can just go, oh, get it fixed and get on with my life. I don't have to suffer and struggle. My God, now the car broke. Where are we going to get the money? If I keep a video one day longer, I don't have apoplexy about it. I can call relatives on the phone and not worry about the phone bill so much. These are nice things. They free us up. They're simple things. I love writing bills. I love writing to the electric company and the gas company because I help support hardworking staff at those companies. I feel like I'm being a philanthropist whenever I write a check to pay bills. I enjoy doing that. Sometimes I pay more than they ask. It really messes up their bookkeeping. Let me tell you about a successful failure. Sparky failed every subject in the 8th grade. Every subject. In high school, he got a 0 in physics and flunked Latin, algebra, and English. He didn't do much better in sports. Although he managed to make the school's golf team, he promptly lost the only important match of the season. There was a consolation match. He lost that too. Sparky was socially awkward, not actually disliked by the other students. No one cared that much. He was astonished if a classmate ever said hello to him outside the school hours. He might have fared okay in dating, but Sparky was too shy to ask. But one thing was important to Sparky, drawing. He was proud of his artwork. Of course, no one else appreciated it. In his senior year in high school, he submitted some cartoons to the editors of the yearbook. The cartoons were turned down. Despite this particular rejection, Sparky continued his quest to become a professional artist. After completing high school, he wrote a letter to the Walt Disney Studios, which asked him to send samples of his artwork, and the subject for a cartoon was suggested. Sparky spent a great deal of time drawing the proposed cartoon and other drawings he submitted. Finally, the reply came. Another rejection. So Sparky decided to write his own autobiography in cartoons. He described his childhood self, a little boy, a loser, and a chronic underachiever. This cartoon character would soon become famous worldwide. Sparky, the boy who had such lack of success in school and whose work was rejected again and again, was named Charles Schulz, creator of the Peanuts comic strip about Charlie Brown, whose kite would never fly, and who never succeeded in kicking a football. He had a slow year last year. Charlie Schulz only made $40 million. In his book, Confidence, Alan Loy McGinnis cites a beautiful example of the same point I'm making about finding your talents in the story of Yoshihiko Yamamoto of Nagoya City, Japan. When he was 6 years old, Yoshihiko's parents learned that he suffered from hydrocephalus, an abnormal accumulation of fluid on the brain, and that their son was mentally retarded. A hearing loss strangled his speech, and his IQ never tested higher than 47. But Yoshihiko acquired a new special education teacher, Takahashi Kawasaki, who liked his new, well-behaved pupil. Gradually, the boy began to smile in class and slowly learned to copy his letters from a chalkboard and to write his name. He spent long hours painstakingly copying cartoons from books and magazines. One day, Yoshihiko Yamamoto drew an accurate sketch of the Nagoya Castle. The clear lines reminded his teacher of a print. He had the boy transfer his design to a woodblock and encouraged him to concentrate on printmaking. Eventually, Kawasaki entered some of his pupils' prints in an art contest. He won first place. Today, bankers and shopkeepers buy the students' work to adorn their walls, although Yoshihiko Yamamoto does not have an IQ high as most. And has other limitations, he is doing the best he can with what he has, capitalizing on his strong points. What are your strong points? Often we don't take the risk. We just sit in an office and work, which is great. Whatever we do, I'll make this emphasis, is great. But what talent might you have that you haven't fully explored? Is it writing? Is it painting? Is it music? Is it speaking? What is it? Explore that. That's how we create abundance, by providing a service for other people. Not focusing on how much money we can make. That's incidental. If money is the root of all evil, it's only because it's money being the primary goal. It's like deciding we want to do sports someday just to get some trophies on the wall. It's missing the point. But by providing a service, you can achieve abundance in life. And again, unless there are self-worth issues or beliefs about, I don't know if money's so good. What's wrong with abundance, right? As Kathleen Norris reminds us, despite the cost of living, it's still popular. Whether you work in an office, in a corporation, or work for yourself, there are two secrets to success in your career, especially if you work as an entrepreneur. Those two secrets are this. The first secret is to be good at what you do. Sounds obvious, but that's the first thing. Work hard, learn what you can, and be good at what you do. But the second and most difficult secret is the P word. Be good at promoting what you do. I know many people, whether they're psychotherapists, massage therapists, artists, musicians, they're good at what they do. They work really hard at it. And they'd much rather spend time honing their craft than that promotion stuff, that marketing stuff. And again, there are money issues coming in here. I don't know if you feel that way. But promotion is absolutely essential. The way I look at it is this. If you're not good at what you do, lay low for a while. You know, just lay low and work on until you're good at what you do. Practice. But if you're good at what you do, if you provide a service to other people, how can you help them if they don't know you exist? So you're not just doing a service for yourself. It's not just self-serving. You're doing a service for other people by letting them know about you. So you have to reach a point. Do you believe in yourself? Are you helpful to people? If you are, no matter what you do, promote yourself. Whether you're in a corporation, promote yourself. Let people know of the work you're doing. They're not going to mind read. And in doing so, you can make a bigger difference for other people. And if you're willing to do that, it makes a difference. Because you know what? There are a lot of people out there, and you know who some of them are, who are very good at promoting what they do and not very good at doing what they do. And sometimes those of us who are good at what we do, we kind of resent them or envy them. But instead of resenting them, recognize they're doing one of the two things you ought to be doing. I knew two teachers. They were both good teachers. They were in my high school. One of them seemed to have more charisma. They were behind themselves. They were more outrageous. They promoted themselves. They became a personality. Kids talked about them after class. They got excited about their material. The other teacher was a good teacher, but they were very modest and shy. They didn't have the same impact on the kids because they wouldn't promote themselves. We were given this personality for some reason. God knows, right? Some people go, oh, the ego is bad. The same people who don't like money much, they say, the ego is bad. I've got to get rid of my ego. That person has a big ego. What's the ego? The ego is just our sense of self. It's our identity, our history, our sense of self. The problem happens with ego is when we think it's only, that's all we are. But I use my ego to teach, to learn, to serve. It's just our personality, for what it's worth. Promote yourself. You can be humble too. You know, I used to be humble. But I stopped after hearing a quotation by Golda Meir. She said, don't be so humble, you're not that great. One of the major malaises, one of the major problems in American life today, and maybe in Europe as well, but more in America, we've forgotten to appreciate what we do for a living. Whatever it is, if you work as an assistant in an office to someone, you're important to that person you're assisting. You make a difference. Probably half run the business. whatever you do in life is valuable. It's your career. It's precious. If one day you want to go to another career that pays better or is more stimulating to you or challenges you more, great. At the appropriate time, go for it. But whatever you do is valuable. Martin Luther King said it as well as I possibly could. Let me share his words. Whatever your life work is, do it well. Do it so well that no one else could do it better. If it falls in your lot to be a street sweeper, sweep streets like Michelangelo painted pictures, like Shakespeare wrote poetry, like Beethoven composed music. If you don't like your career, make up your own. Ron Kaufman, an old friend of mine, grew up liking one thing in life, throwing frisbees. He loved throwing frisbees. He'd be playing frisbee golf and challenge frisbee. But he was getting close to 30 years old. And his parents were saying, Ron, is it time you kind of got an occupation? But he just loved frisbees. He also, though, had a feeling for world peace. He'd always had a feel for, we need to bring the countries together. One day it struck him. He said, I know. And he went to the Wham-O Corporation. And he asked them if they would give him a gift of 500 frisbees. On the frisbees printed world peace in Russian and English. And he found a sponsor, and they sent him to Russia as a frisbee goodwill ambassador. He went to Russia, and he went to people in the streets. He'd walk through the square, like in Moscow, and he'd walk up to people, and halting Russian, partly in English, he'd show them the frisbee and show them how it worked. People were getting so excited. They hadn't seen these. And he'd teach them to throw frisbees. And these frisbees with world peace on it, in Russian and English, were flying all over the squares, all over. He traveled throughout Russia. He got to know the country so well and made so many wonderful contacts that he ended up going back again and again doing frisbee tours, leading people, other people. He'd bring them, they'd pay him money to bring them to Russia, and they'd do frisbee tours and meet the people and so on. He ended up marrying a Russian wife and so on. He's still doing it as far as I know. It was a while ago. So the point is, if you're not sure of your occupation, make up your own. The best thing you can tell your children about career is to find out what they love to do and get someone to pay them for it. I had a friend, Larry. That's his real name. He was a tax accountant. Larry told me in confidence one day that a lot of his clients complained that he charged too much. Actually, he was in the lower end, below the middle, in terms of the range for tax accountants. He was charging less than most, but his clientele complained a lot. And one day he said, enough of this. He'd gone through some self-worth considerations in terms of how much he should charge for his services. And so he decided to raise his price. He almost doubled his price, which put it in the mid to high range. But he said, I'm going to give really good service. He renovated his headquarters. People weren't kept waiting. He hired a few more people. He just upgraded everything. And he lost about half his clientele who said, what? This kind of fees? And they quit. But he started attracting new clientele. And he noticed about a year and a half later, he had more than double the clientele, well more than double, and nobody complained anymore. Now, I don't know if there's a moral there. When you assume, if I charge people less and less and less, if I say I'll do it on a sliding scale, people have so many money issues. I had a guy who said, I can't afford, I was doing a life reading. I wrote a book called The Life You Were Born to Live. It's about life purpose information. And he said, I can't afford your reading. I said, I knew him. He was an acquaintance of mine. I said, oh, you have a nice little TV set. I'll take that in trade. He said, oh, I just remembered where I can get the money. People have many issues about money. They can't afford this, but they can afford, you know, their six pack every other day or whatever it is, you know. So you're not necessarily doing people a favor by charging them less money. Think about it. And the point of Larry's story is, don't charge less, give more. That's your responsibility. Instead of going down, 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 give more. A good chance to apply your will to money is to live below your means. Thomas Stanley, in his book, The Millionaire Next Door, emphasized this. He said, millionaires are guys who own the hardware store down the street. They're not necessarily in Las Vegas, but they're people who live below their means. They don't deprive themselves, but they live frugally. They have a Sears card instead of a Neiman Marcus card. They drive an older Ford instead of a Mercedes. They're not ostentatious, but they save money and they work with it and they also contribute to people. Live below your means. It's one key. Because no matter how much you make, if you spend more, you know what happens. These are some practical things I wanted to point out, but based on larger principles. Money is energy, develops efficiency and stability. Let me get an idea. How many people here have developed sufficiency where money is no longer really an issue with you one way or the other? It's just a thing in life. Okay, so one hand, two, three, four, five hands go up. So most of us are working on this area. There's no magic thing. Money's not my religion. It's not about dare to be great and make $1 billion, you know, in real estate or whatever. First, examine your attitudes toward money. Did anything I say kind of quirk? Did it hook anything in you? When you explore that, you can begin to just provide a service. I've been broke. Now I'm better off because I've provided a useful service, writing books. That's my situation. I've been both places, and overall, I prefer providing a valuable service and clearing up those money things. The fourth gateway. As you do, you'll be amazed how much energy is released and how much your attention is freed to notice the beauty around you in life.